Well, I guess I've been here a week, and it's clear that having lots of interesting talks and discussions on turbulence in the interstellar medium and H1 clouds and the like. So I thought perhaps today it was, as they say, time for something completely different. That is, studying turbulence and accretion flows and accretion flows in general. And more important, I thought you probably heard enough from Eve about the work we're doing jointly on turbulence in the interstellar medium. And so this is other work that I thought you might be interested in today. So I thought I would, also in keeping with the spirit of these discussion sections, feel free to interrupt me, and I'll try to keep this informal. I thought I would give you just a very quick review by way of motivation of where we stand in studying turbulence and transport processes in accretion disks. At the moment, our understanding is that angular-momentum transport in disks occurs via MHD turbulence. And this turbulence is driven by a linear instability that Baldwin and Hawley pointed out in 91. That is, whenever the angular frequency is decreasing with radius, as it is in a Keplerian disk, then any weakly magnetized disk is linearly unstable. And once the instability has been identified and through a linear analysis, then all the important questions turn to what is the nonlinear saturation mechanism and consequences of the instability. And to investigate that, a number of groups, including myself, Axel Brandenburg, and others, have been using MHD simulations to follow the growth of this instability, saturation, and study its properties. Almost all of these simulations to date have been done in the local frame. That is, you have a large accretion disk around some astrophysical object, and you extract a small three-dimensional volume of that accretion disk, and you evolve the equations of motion in that small volume under varying different parameters, such as the magnetic field direction and the initial magnetic field strength, and you study how this turbulence evolves and how it saturates in this small little volume, without regard to how the overall structure of the disk is changed by this turbulence. And so all this previous work has been through these local simulations. And just, again, by way of summary, typical result. This shows the density on two faces of the three-dimensional computational volume for one of these calculations. The disk midplane here is in the center of the box. The vertical direction is the vertical height of the disk. This direction here is the radial direction, and this is the azimuthal direction. And also shown are the magnetic field lines through a two-dimensional slice below the midplane of the disk. And you can see the magnetic field is very highly tangled, changes both its magnitude and direction on lots of scales, and as well the density field is very, very highly complex and turbulent. As you evolve this in time, this flow just continuously fluctuates. These magnetic field lines flap around all the time.
Does that reflect the true shape of the domain? So the radial extent is small?
The radial extent is small compared to the azimuthal extent, that's correct. That's right. Because there is a preference for the azimuthal direction because of the shear, so it makes sense to extend the domain in that direction.
So the vertical field initially,
so there's been a large range of studies involving purely azimuthal fields, or purely vertical fields, or vertical fields with no net flux, that is, fields that change sign over some distance, and combinations thereof. There's no real important difference between the runs. The major difference is whether or not the box contains a net flux. If the box contains a net flux, then the turbulence is different than if it doesn't contain. Different in the sense that saturation amplitude is a little bit higher. Okay, so this is all by way of summary. And so what have we learned? I haven't shown these results, but well, John Hawley and Steve Baldwin both gave talks at the recent workshop that was held a few weeks ago, and some of these results are just restating what they said. Hydrodynamical turbulence does not seem to provide significant angular-momentum transport. If you go into this three-dimensional volume in a hydrodynamical calculation and you stir it with a spoon, you don't get any significant transport because there aren't any correlations between VR and delta V5 to give you transport. But this MHD turbulence driven by this pH instability does provide for significant amounts of transport. The Reynolds stress normalized by the pressure, this famous alpha parameter, varies between 10 to minus 2 up to a few tenths in different simulations depending on whether or not the box is a net volume or net flux or not. Maxwell stress always dominates the Reynolds stress. the power spectrum of the turbulence is consistent with Kolmogorov, although it's very anisotropic. It produces dynamo action in the disk in the simplest sense of a dynamo, that is, it amplifies and maintains a strong magnetic field in the face of dissipation, and persists even if you add finite dissipation, finite conductivity, as long as the magnetic Reynolds number is greater than around 10,000 or so.
What is the primary characteristic of the anisotropy?
The azimuthal direction, again, is always favored, so the magnetic energy is always larger in this in the phi direction, so the anisotropic in the phi direction. Okay. So, this is, yes?
Question. Does the range of alpha there correspond to ranges of beta as well? We can correlate the alpha with the beta?
There is a weak correlation with beta, but not one-to-one, I don't think. The most important difference, I think, between these values is whether or not the volume contains a net magnetic flux or not. But boxes which have a net vertical flux give you the highest alphas.
Because
yes.
It's an anisotropy?
Yes.
Is that due to rotation or
yes.
Due to magnetic field?
No, it's rotation. I mean, shear is a dominant component of the flow, and it's just producing more B phi.
It shakes out of everything.
It shakes. It's a good way to say it. B.
I mean, so, if you agree actually that the alpha, if you take it as a function of time, then models, for example, in my model, as a function of time, it does vary with the theta, but it's also a function of time. And this curve actually fits with the geo curves as well.
Mm-hmm.
They all fit on one line. So alpha is proportional to B squared, plus the Mach set.
Yes. It is, well, I mean, as I say, there is a correlation, but it's not the only thing that determines it. Yes. So, this is all work done on the local properties of this instability and the local properties of the turbulence that it drives. But obviously, a major question is
if you what started with very, very weak field and that flux,
yes.
Then
these do start with very, very weak field because it's a weak field instability.
There's a difference between starting with. I mean, the net flux would be incredibly small with a very, very weak field.
But that it's non-zero is important, I think, because it always gives you, you can never destroy this net flux, no matter what you do with the turbulence.
If so it varies, if the B
but,
associated with the net flux is very,
but
very
what's
small.
Important to know is that the growth rates of the unstable modes don't depend on the strength of the magnetic field. So if you have a weak magnetic field, you have the mechanism for always producing new turbulence out of this mean field at a rate which is independent of the strength of that field.
And then if you can pose back to the meta, if it's weaker than the dynamo field.
Well, there's no mean dynamo here, so there's no mean dynamo field that's generated. The net flux is always dominated by what you put in. It's always the same, never changes.
But is there a large scale dynamo field of some kind?
Yes, because the spectrum is Kolmogorov, it's a decreasing power law. There's always most of the power is on the largest scale in the box. So there are the biggest, the most important field loops are those that are the size of the box. Yet they still have both signs contained within the box. There's no net flux.
But if that's true, then why should it care about this incredibly weak and short net flux?
Because you can. In the zero net field case, you can the dynamo can actually reconnect the field as well, and you can you don't have a background magnetic field, a background unstable mode that's always present on this mean field. So when the field becomes highly tangled, now the instability is working off this nonlinearly fluctuating tangled field, and so what you learn about the linear analysis it's not clear how to apply here, but what seems to be true is that when there's a net flux, there's always a mean field from which there are unstable vertical modes present that you can drive off of, and that seems to increase the level of the turbulence. And makes alpha a little larger.
Is there any scaling of this alpha with the magnitude of this mean field?
Right, that's what Steve's been asking. And I don't know if there. And I have to get back to you to know if there's a precise relationship between the two. But my answer, I think, is no. That the critical thing is whether or not there is a mean field or not.
You make it much longer if it's very weak, is it? Or?
One problem is if you make it too weak. So while the growth rates don't change with the field strength, then the most unstable wavelength does change. If the field gets too weak, the most unstable wavelength is not resolved. Once you don't resolve it anymore, then you start to see changes between field strengths. Again, for a resolved most unstable wavelength.
Time, the dynamo has made big loops into a clay. I'm not quite sure how it does that, but it's made big loops that are really strong. And the field associated with this mean flux is really, really weak. How can it make any difference?
I guess if there's a mean field which is very time dependent, the moment when instance when the mean field is not there and the whole thing is going to collapse.
The turbulence is very time dependent, so the magnetic energy is fluctuating by order unity in time. So these are statements about the average time average properties of the flow. For example, the time average alpha. So yes, there are strong field loops which come and go at certain times. They have geometries which are very complicated, so that you can't always fit unstable wavelengths on these geometries. And so the net result is that when there is a mean field present, there's always a resolved unstable wavelength that you can never get rid of, and so there's always a source of turbulence present which keeps stirring it up. It can never die away, and that's what keeps it going at a high amplitude. With a no net flux, then there are certain periods of time where the field can die away a lot, and so the average time averaged strength is less. It would be nice to have a theory of the nonlinear.
If you go to the higher connectivity limit, and you didn't really stress this point, but if you go to the high connectivity limit, then the field is going linearly because of the shear, and the component of the shear. And so that would be a story.
That's true whether there's net flux or not.
This is the summary after all.
Sorry. You can think of a very simple problem where you have a shear plug in 2D. If you have a random field with no net flux, then there's no reason for your magnetic energy not to carry away from zero. If you have a magnetic field with a mean flux, then your solution is very different. You get a solution with a large scale field because the shear is shearing out. It's a completely different solution. Even though the net flux you impose is very, very good.
Not convinced, but perhaps we can turn to it later. Okay, so it's clear that moving to global models is an interesting thing to do. So how do we do that? Well, a first step.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
Is K5 of the instability, the K in direction of zero, is that?
No.
The most unstable modes?
No. The most unstable modes, the fastest growing modes are associated with KZ. There are finite K5 values and KR values as well. So a first step is to go to sort of quasi-global stratified models. That is, you take the same three-dimensional volume, but rather than it being a small piece embedded in the disk, now you take a column out of the disk and you resolve the vertical structure of the disk and you look at the corona versus the midplane of the disk. So for example, the computational volume is now stretched in the vertical direction over a total of 10 scale heights, and you're going to have this turbulent disk core in the middle here. And this kind of a calculation allows you to look at what the corona, if there is one, by the disk is like. What is the connection between this weakly magnetized turbulent disk midplane and what's going on above and below the disk? Now these calculations are somewhat challenging because the Alphane speed up here can get extremely large because the density is so low, especially for an isothermal disk, which is going, density is going down like a Gaussian. So to get around that, you have to use some special numerical techniques, but nonetheless, it can be done. It allows you also to use free outflow boundary conditions here rather than rigid walls or periodic or anything else. You can use outflow boundary conditions because the magnetic field will become less tangled as you get towards the top. It'll become more force-free. Handling a tangled magnetic field through a boundary is is very, very difficult, probably impossible, to have a stress-free boundary on a turbulent magnetic field. So this allows you to remove the boundary away from where this magnetic field is tangled up. And so, again, this is still summary, so I won't show you very much, but Kristen Miller, who's just graduated from Maryland, looked at this problem, did calculations of these stratified disks spanning five scale heights above and below the midplane. One good way to show the results, I think, is using these so-called space-time diagrams. That is, you average any quantity over horizontal planes, so that gives you a one-dimensional function versus height, and then you plot that versus time. You make a 2D image of that, and that shows you how the vertical structure of the disk is changing in time. And so, if you look at the magnetic energy this way, you can clearly see how here's a linear phase of the instability, then it goes nonlinear and saturates and generates turbulence in the midplane of the disk as you continue the calculation over 50 orbits in this case. And you can see the buoyant rise of magnetic flux tubes out of this disk in this kind of a plot. And you can see magnetic field and magnetic energy is being levitated out of the midplane where it's being produced by this dynamo, and it's being brought up into the corona where it's being dissipated. Basically, the magnetic field is extremely tangled, and as it rises up into a low-density region, it becomes, beta gets smaller and smaller and smaller, so the field then can relax. It can then straighten itself out, become force-free, it reduces its magnetic energy when it does that, and so it dissipates at the top and the bottom. And so we can measure, for example, the pointing flux through, say, two scale heights, and measure how much energy is coming out of the disk midplane and into the corona. It's very, very significant. Something like 25% of the magnetic energy generated by the turbulence in the midplane of this disk is being dissipated in the corona and being transported by a pointing flux. And so this has all has important implications for hot, low-density, strongly magnetized corona above accretion disks. In fact, there's probably some very strong analogies to in this situation to what's going on in the sun, where magnetic field is being generated and transported and then producing a hot, highly magnetized corona above the sun. And so it's natural to make connections to that case, although there's also some very important differences. And that is, the turbulence in this case is being driven by the magnetic field in the midplane. That's not true of the sun. And so it's tempting to make connections, but one should be cautious as well. But it does allow us to self-consistently calculate the structure of a corona, which is being self-generated by the turbulence in the midplane of this disk.
Could I just ask what your initial condition field, magnetic field?
This particular case was a toroidal field, purely toroidal field, which is contained within two scale heights. And there was zero magnetic field above that.
And does that make any difference to the buoyancy that you see?
No, because the amplification of the field here is enormous. And so this field is I think it's beta 400 initially here. And so it's not buoyant at all. Until it's amplified, beta getting closer to 1, it doesn't come out of the disk.
So if you start with no net flux, you still get buoyant?
Yes, that's correct.
But the buoyant is very tangled already.
Yes, exactly.
It's not simple Parker loops.
No, and it would be a mistake to identify this as the Parker instability, I think, because these are not ordered fields along one unstable wavelength, the Parker mode. These are just turbulent fluctuations that are slightly more buoyant than their surroundings and therefore come out.
This is presumably convectively stable.
Yes, yes. So that's about as far as one can go.
Buoyancy also has to really. You can't take a bundle of field lines that aren't attached to something. It could be well attached to field lines that are going out of the bottom too. I mean,
sometimes they do, but this field is saturating because of reconnection. This is not; it does not stay unattached, as it were. Reconnection is very important to the saturation mechanism of the instability, and so. Magnetic field loops can become detached and rise out of the disk. This is one big difference between this kind of a dynamo and those that have been studied for the galaxy, for example, and that is flux freezing does not strictly apply here. Reconnection is always going to be important, not only the field topology, but also the nature of the turbulence as well. Yes. That's what I mentioned earlier, that the amplitudes don't change if the Reynolds number is below or above 20,000 or so. Nor do they change with numerical resolution. So if you take an ideal MHD where the only dissipation now is numerical, and as long as you're resolving the most unstable wavelengths, then the saturation amplitude in the mean sense stays roughly the same. Absolutely not. You're not. Absolutely, of course, you're not. So there is some imposed. I mean, there, I think there's a good analogy to the turbulence calculations where the dissipation is at the grid scale, not at the viscous scale, which is many, many orders of magnitude smaller than what's going on here. So the dissipation here is all at the grid scale, many, many, many orders of magnitude larger than the real dissipation scale. So our turbulent cascade here is very small compared to what it would be in a real disk. Whether that really makes a difference, the hints are perhaps no, because again, as you vary the resolution, as long as the most unstable wavelengths are resolved in a linear phase, then it doesn't seem to make much difference.
This is a question for a black hole, right?
These so far apply to disks in any context. Could be a protostar, could be
it's very black hole. Different if it is around a star, which is pretty cold, and something that's at kilovolts and maybe even megavolts, where the resistance will be zero.
Only in protostellar disks, if you're outside, say, a tenth or so or more of AU, the temperature has to be really cold, below 1,000 Kelvin, before you can get in a low enough ionization fraction that doesn't matter. Ionization fractions as small as 10 to the minus 13. That is one ion per 10 to the 13 neutrons is enough to make this instability go.
I'm worried that you're really so hot that your resistance is incredibly tiny. You're in this large magnetic Prandtl number, which is.
So the resistivity is very, very large, and the.
The hotter you get, the bigger the.
So, but that's the one regime we can get to. We can put in a large resistivity and a small viscosity.
Sorry?
But we can't, right? It's difficult to get to that regime because. If you want to put in a large viscosity and a small resistivity, if you want to have a large separation of scales between the resistive and viscous layers, you need a very, very high numerical resolution because you want to make sure that the viscous scale is much smaller than the shear length in the disk, so that you're not transporting angular momentum just through sheer viscosity. So you've got to keep the viscous layer small, and then you've got to make the resistance layer that many times smaller. So that has not been looked at.
But such process in the buoyant rise out of the disk relying on reconnection, right?
Perhaps. I mean, we haven't looked at that regime. No one has been able to examine that regime yet. All we can look at so far are these Prandtl number 1 and the resistive scale bigger than the viscous scale.
Tell us, what is your hero calculation in terms of the grid resolution?
These are very moderate, actually, because these are already very old. Some of these are 5 years old now. So I think our largest is John's done 256 cubed with no magnetic field, I believe. I think my largest is 256 squared by 128. Nowadays, hero simulation would be 512 cubed, I think. It's a regime that perhaps could be attempted.
Do you see a difference in the saturation level for the magnetic field on your local simulation because of this model of buoyancy from the area where...
No, actually, if you look at just the midplane of the disk, then no. Because again, the saturation is not being dominated by this buoyant rise. 25%, but it's not at all. It's not the majority. It's still the minority of the magnetic energy being lost to this buoyancy.
What is it that causes the saturation?
I'm sorry?
What is it that dominates the saturation?
It is local dissipation, reconnection, and magnetic dissipation. So we're still reviewing.
Dissipation is saturated or
magnetic dissipation. So reconnection and magnetic diffusivity is what saturates the instability.
We're still discussing this. This is great.
Sorry?
We're still discussing.
Good. Yeah, great. Good. All right. There is more to come. So review of things that are much newer. We're getting closer to really new stuff. That is going to fully global models. What does it take to go to a fully global model? Well, what's an example of an experiment of a fully global model? What could you compute? Now we've got to calculate the evolution structure of the entire disk. And you want the disk to be set up self-consistently. You want the structure of the disk to evolve on its own, into its own self-consistent structure. How do we do that? Well, one idea, one possibility is to do an idealized experiment of taking point source gravitational potential well here, surrounded with a donut of gas, a torus, and let this torus accrete inwards and set up a structure, an accretion flow, and study the properties of that accretion flow. And that's what we're going to do here. And this torus, you can begin from there's some attractive properties of this kind of experiment, because you can begin from an exact equilibrium state. You can begin from a pressure-supported torus for which there are exact solutions when the angular momentum goes like a power law of the radius. And you also know that in axisymmetry, this torus won't do anything in just pure hydrodynamics. That is, there is no angular momentum transport processes and no instabilities in axisymmetry. So you'll have to add something to make it start accreting. That could be a magnetic field, or it could be something else. So we'll study what happens when we do something to this torus and make it start accreting. We're going to look at specific angular momentum constant initially. That gives you one particular family of solutions for these tori initially. It doesn't really matter. An adiabatic equation of state, which means that the flow can't lose energy as it accretes inward. So it's a non-radiative accretion flow. This makes the flow get very thick, pressure supported, which makes it easier to resolve numerically. And it's an important class of solutions that's relevant to accretion onto compact objects, where the dynamical time might be much less than the cooling time. And so those flows don't lose energy radiatively, and so they remain pressure supported, they remain thick. But it's going to narrow the astrophysical application of these flows. It doesn't apply now to protostars, it applies to compact objects, where the cooling time is much longer than the dynamical time. And we'll look at Newtonian potentials and the Paczynski-Wieda potential, which is as much as I get as close to doing GR. It's not at all doing GR. However, this potential represents the Schwarzschild potential of the black hole. The dynamical properties of the Schwarzschild potential very well, actually. For example, it gets the orbit of the last stable circular orbit correct. And that's going to have an important effect. Okay, so we have these idealized experiments. We can do.
Before you go into that in detail, is there an effort? So you're describing an effort that's going more and more global.
Yes.
Is there also an effort going more and more local, which gets the difference between the. To look at hotter and hotter disks, for example. Or is the bulk of the effort right now going towards more global simulation?
I think there are parallel tracks. I think at the moment, most of the momentum seems to be going towards more and more global calculations. However, there's still a number of interesting problems to look at in the local boxes. To date, this means adding more microphysics. Recently, we put in resistivity, studied the effect of resistivity. Unable to put in viscosity with the resolutions that we could afford, but perhaps with newer machines, this is going to become possible. But there's still certainly an interest in this. Yes. But I think many of the astrophysically interesting questions are in the global models, because the global models you can compare to observations. The local models you cannot. You don't know what the structure of the disk is. You don't know what the emission properties are. These global models potentially you can compare directly to observations, and so that sort of gives them an extra level of motivation. So I'll sort of describe four kinds of experiments, and I won't go into much detail into all of them, but I'll just point out, if you ask yourself, what kind of things could I do with this torus? I could add an anomalous shear stress to this hydrodynamical torus and make it start to accrete, and ask what is the structure of this resulting shear flow. The stress is not viscosity. If you add viscosity and you make this torus molasses, then its flow structure is going to be different than an astrophysical plasma. So you want to add just a shear stress in the angular momentum equation to give you angular momentum transport and accretion. Why is this interesting? Because there's a lot of work being done on hydrodynamical shear flows around compact objects. And you'd like to know, are the steady state solutions that have been studied for a long time, are they reached by these numerical simulations? Do two-dimensional simulations reproduce these self-similar steady state solutions? You can do the same thing again in three dimensions. Ask what difference that makes. In particular, in 3D, there is an instability in the initial state, the Pappalozzi-Pringle instability, a global instability in this torus. You could ask, does that affect the flow? Or more generically, does the three-dimensional turbulence have a difference to the flow structure compared to the two-dimensional case? And then finally, we can forget about this anomalous shear stress. Stick in weak magnetic fields, which you know are unstable to the Balotelli instability, and see what they do. And look at a self-consistent accretion flow generated by the Balotelli instability, both in two dimensions and in three dimensions.
But the scheme is generally that you'll have a donut and you want to make a pancake out of it.
Yes, although it's going to be a very, very thick pancake as you get closer and closer to the center. That's correct.
And And you don't replenish anything about the...
No. There's a fixed amount of mass in the torus, and you don't add any more. Why? Because I don't know how to add any more. To add more, you also need to know what the specific angle momentum of that stuff you're adding, what its pressure is, and everything else. And you worry that you're going to affect the flow by adding anything. I want it just to be, it's a closed box, which I'm allowing to evolve through just the equations of motion. So again, I sort of motivate this very theoretically. We want to understand the global properties of the bulbous hull instability and the disk structure produced by it. But really, again, there's a lot of astrophysical motivation because these calculations are directly relevant to observations of low luminosity accretion on compact objects, things like the galactic center and the centers of other galaxies. There's been a long-standing problem as to why the X-ray flux from these sources is so low. And there's a class of solutions being developed to help account for that. But Chandra has been making things even worse because what have previously been upper limits on X-ray fluxes have become X-ray detections. For example, the galactic center, the detection for the flux is 4 times lower than what the upper limit was before. And this makes getting models that fit the data even more difficult. And moreover, there is a possibility, it has yet to be confirmed, the possibility that the emission in Sag A star is polarized. It's very difficult to understand how that could be the case if the flow has a very high accretion rate and the density in the center is very high. And so there are long-standing theoretical issues about accretion in these objects, and these experiments can maybe shed some light onto those. Okay, so let's just return to what the experiments are. Of course, these kind of problems have been studied before. It's not the first time that something like this has been done. What makes this different? We start from this equilibrium state. We're going to use a spherical polar mesh with a logarithmically spaced grid zones, kind of like an adapted mesh, so that you can really resolve what's going on in the middle over many orders of magnitude in scale here, up to 3 orders of magnitude between the inner edge and the outer edge of the disk in radius. So you have a very large dynamic range in radius to see what's going on. A typical model has an inner boundary at r equals 1, and then the torus, the center of the torus, is located at r equals 100. So there's a 2 orders of magnitude in radial range that this accretion flow can get set up over. And what makes this computationally challenging is because the orbital times, the dynamical times, are changing so rapidly with radius. If you want to follow the flow for one orbit at the center of the torus, that's 1,000 orbits at the inner edge. And so that's, you have to evolve this for tens of thousands of orbits in the middle of the disk to have a few dynamical times in the outer edge. And that means evolving it for a very, very long time. Okay, so let's just turn to the results. Let's look at the hydrodynamical case first, and then turn to the MHD case. So here's evolution, time evolution of this two-dimensional torus. This is slices through the poloidal plane at various times, times marked in orbits at the radius of the initial center of the torus. And what happens? Well, initially...
Have you imposed symmetry, or was that...
Symmetry above and below?
Yeah.
No. No, it's very important not to, actually, for reasons I'll mention in a minute.
But do you perturb this thing? Or?
No perturbations, but you do add this anomalous shear stress. So then, of course, it's going to have to evolve.
Where is the shear stress added?
I'm sorry?
Shear stress, how is it added on this
thing? The shear stress is added to the equations of motion, the angular momentum equation. You add an anomalous transport term to the angular momentum equation, whose form is arbitrary and whose magnitude is a free parameter in the calculation.
That's surface symmetry, sir? Given the initial torus?
Sorry?
Given the initial torus, does it essentially have a...
No, I mean, it follows this famous alpha law. So you put in the shear stress proportional to alpha p, for example, or you can choose other forms for it as well. So it's just an alpha stress added to the angular momentum equation so that these solutions correspond to the analytic solutions that have been generated previously. Okay, so the torus, of course, immediately begins to evolve, fattens up immediately. Stuff goes out, some goes in, as it must. In fact, this evolution of a viscous disk is known, the time evolution is known analytically, and indeed the solution agrees with the analytic solution for the evolution of a viscous ring in its early stages. But then, later on, more complicated dynamical things start happening. For example, you can see that outflow along the surface of the torus begins to produce little KH rolls on the surface, and these keep getting shed every once in a while. And as time goes by, the torus eventually fattens up considerably and generates this very complicated structure in the inner regions. where these wiggles represent large amplitude fluctuations in the density, and the striations in the shading show that there's infall and outflow occurring on a very many different radial scale or very different angles in the flow. There's lots of eddies going on here with inflow and outflow everywhere.
This is the two-dimensional calculation?
This is a two-dimensional calculation.
So that's more orderly.
More orderly, indeed. If you look at the mass accretion rate in this calculation, how much mass makes it through various radii, the inner boundary, 5 times the inner boundary, 10 times the inner boundary, you see that it does level off and saturate. You generate a steady accretion flow. So for the fixed stress, you're now generating a steady mass flux to the disk. In every location, the time average mass flux is the same. So it's reached a steady mass accretion flow. So now you can begin to ask, what are the properties of the steady accretion flow? While it's steady on the time average sense, a snapshot makes it look very, very complicated. If you look at just the inner 10% of the flow, so extract the 1/10 of that little picture I showed you before and look at what's going on right down near the inner boundary, then if you look at the density, the entropy, and the angular momentum compared to the Keplerian value, you can see lots of large amplitude fluctuations in all variables. And there's certain correlations. High density regions seem to be preferentially associated with low entropy blobs, which are falling inwards. And conversely, high entropy little bubbles here associated with low density blobs are moving out. They even have these little mushroom cap shaped structures as they bubble out of this disk. So the flow itself is dominated by this convection, by various very vigorous convection it's undergoing. Accretion is releasing gravitational energy, which is heating the flow, producing unstable entropy stratification, which is driving very strong convection, is making this flow bubble away. And in a time average sense, there's still net accretion though through the flow.
What is your central boundary condition on
this? Here it's just infall, free infall. So whatever crosses the inner boundary never comes back again. And zero stress on that boundary.
Wish them well.
Wish them well. They've gone into the black hole.
And you show into a radius 2, right? And the box goes, and the computation domain goes to 100, right?
Yes.
400 or 100?
That the whole box is 400. The torus originally was at 100. So if you take this flow and you'd take 100 data files at different times and you average them all together, amazingly enough, things become very ordered, in fact. Here's a density, pressure, angular frequency, and so on from this run again. And again, the contours become very, very ordered now. This is the structure of this time average flow. And there are certain properties present. For example, the specific angular momentum and the entropy contours are very nearly parallel, which is what you would expect if the flow is stable to the Hoyland criterion, which is a convective stability criterion in a rotating flow. And so the convection is so efficient that it's driving the entropy gradients to be just slightly super adiabatic, slightly just above what the convective stability limit is. And so that's what's determining the two-dimensional structure of the flow.
In the radial direction, you say, huh? The entropy gradient
actually,
in the radial direction.
Yes, but overall in two dimensions, so these contours are parallel also at other angles, which is an important constraint on the flow. And its structure, in fact.
So the entropy goes to what, the equator, if you go along there?
Entropy is highest along the equator here, I think.
Yeah, right, so it increases. If you go on the periphery from the axis...
No, sorry?
If you go from the axis to the equator...
Yes.
On the periphery, yeah, the entropy increases.
Right. Actually, no, the entropy decreases.
Yeah.
The highest entropy is at the... Right. Well, you have to be careful with adding in the angular momentum gradient as well. I mean, you can't just look at the gradient of S and say that's the unstable direction. So, one thing Nigel, you asked about is there symmetry. You can't impose symmetry here because if you do, these convective eddies have a preferential direction along the midplane and they end up going way out, a very ordered flow. So you have to make it over all angles so that the flow doesn't have any symmetries in the convection.
I don't think he was wishing you to do that. I think he was just accusing you.
Right. No.
Large-scale structures look completely symmetric.
Yeah, initially, yes. Right. But that's the difference between the large, medium, and small. So it's also interesting to look at the radial profiles of these variables, not just their two-dimensional structure, but plot what these variables do versus radius. And interestingly enough, they all become simple power laws. Density is going down like r to minus 1/2. The angular velocity is nearly Keplerian. The dashed line is the Keplerian curve. It's only slightly sub-Keplerian in the inner part. And the radial velocity, though it's much noisier, is consistent with r to minus 1/2 profile. So these are correspond to self-similar solutions, in fact. So this time average flow does indeed reproduce certain aspects of self-similar solutions. In fact, recently, very recently, if you take the ansatz that the flow is marginally stable to the Hoyland criterion, you can then generate self-similar solutions that agree with these simulations exactly. If you didn't know that it was going to be stable to Hoyland, you couldn't do that before you began. But if you know that's what you should do, you get this exact solution from self-similar theory, which is quite interesting. So one other important result is to look at mass fluxes in the calculation. That is, how much mass is being transported inwards? I mean, first put the definitions up here. How much mass is being transported inwards, that is with negative velocity, negative radial velocity? This is integrated over all angles, so it's the total mass inflow rate over all angles. Versus how much is going out, the difference between, or sorry, the same integral but now with positive radial velocities. And then, of course, the sum of those two things is the mass accretion rate. If there's any asymmetry between the inflow and outflow, that's a net mass accretion rate. And so here are plotted those for two different models using different shear stresses, different forms for this anomalous shear stress. But it doesn't matter what form you take. The important result is that the mass inflow rate is increasing rapidly with radius. It's nearly balanced exactly by a mass outflow rate. That is, these convective eddies are transporting mass both in and out. There's a very large amount of mass associated with all these eddies. But the asymmetry between the two is very small and set by what's going on at the inner boundary. And so the net mass accretion rate compared to certain self-similar models is actually quite low. It's not being imposed from the outside, but being imposed on the inside, really. So the mass accretion rate for this kind of a flow would be much, much lower than you might expect.
Why do you measure something like m dot in and m dot out? I know, because one is really...
Originally, we were looking for how much mass outflow there was in a wind. But this m dot out is not associated with a wind because it's not unbound. So the net result is that the mass lost in a wind is zero. If you could turn this around and lose it from the grid, you might have the same kind of profile for the variables. But then that mass wouldn't be associated with just convective eddies. It would be inflow, outflow, and mass accretion. That corresponds to yet another set of self-similar solutions.
I mean, one of them basically measures how many victims go in that direction, how many go in that direction.
Yes.
And you're the gatekeeper, and that you find that actually very few
right.
are out of balance.
Right. It's still instructive to understand this flow, realize that it's very, very dynamic and time dependent, that there is a lot of victims going in and out. It's not just all laminar inflow, all heading for the gallows. There's a lot of them that are coming back out again.
As is true of most convective systems.
Mm-hmm.
What happens, just with my little question, what happens to the large mass flow of large and the small one? Where does the mass go in between those?
It gets turned around. So whatever is coming in at large R, the vast majority of it, 1 minus epsilon, gets turned around and turned into this dotted line coming back out again. And only a tiny fraction of it, proportional to R over R naught,
so
gets all the way in.
Is it true then that delicate balance is affected by the shear stress?
No, because those two different forms of the shear stress gave you largely the same results. So that result is independent. And why? Because the convection is still present regardless of the form of the shear stress. And it's the convection
just
that's doing
this. Just when you subtract two large quantities that give you nearly zero, it's a very dangerous thing.
Yes, but I can also calculate the integrated mass flux through the inner boundary.
Which is do it directly.
Yeah.
He's done a signed interval.
But what I'm saying is that it represents a large amount of turbulence, and you have very strong counter flows, is what he's saying.
Right.
Yeah. Well, everything's going on, and slowly the damn thing is settling, right? The center of gravity is slowly moving in.
Indeed. I mean, I have a fixed amount of mass, so if I evolve this for 1,000 orbits of the torus, then it'll all fall in the hole. Some of it will actually get lost to the outer grid. But I've only gone 10 or 20 orbits in this case. So the amount of mass we lose is not that much. So the next experiment I told you about was to do this in 3D. And this is, of course, a lot more expensive and a lot more difficult to do. It's the same grid, the same problem, same torus initially, but now done with, say, 128 grid points in the phi direction, as well as all these grid points at each polar slice. So it makes it much more difficult to do the calculation. And what's unfortunate is that not much changes. It's, at the end of the day, there's not really new, there's not a whole lot of new interesting things going on in this calculation, in the sense that the flow structure remains very much the same as before. The time average two-dimensional structure is the same. The time average radial profiles of all the variables are still the same as before. And the mass inflow and outflow rates stay the same as well. But to show you the structure in a poloidal plane, which is what I was showing before, versus the equatorial plane, there is certainly a lot of global weight. Sorry?
What are you plotting?
This is the density, I'm sorry. Logarithm of density now in the poloidal and equatorial planes. So there is a lot of non-azimuthal structure here, a lot of asymmetrical waves that are present here. But it doesn't really seem to change the qualitative nature of the steady state flow. And one thing that means is that the turbulence in three dimensions is not transporting very much angular momentum. If it were, then this flow would be different. Sorry.
Well, the scale of your convection must be fairly small when it's also in the two-dimensional story, right?
Scale meaning the smallest eddies, or the
that's right.
Yes.
If you ask what the correlation lengths were on the transport scales.
Right. I haven't looked at sort of power spectra in those calculations to know whether there is or what the structure is in Fourier space. So let me not dwell on the 3D case, but to turn instead to the MHD case. Which
actually, sure. Did you do victims in versus victim out?
Yes, yes. And again, it's largely the same.
Yes. Yeah. And was there any z dependence on that? Was was it preferentially in or out at z equals zero, or is z farther out?
So those are all integrated over angle.
Yeah.
So I haven't actually looked to see whether there is a difference at different angles.
Yeah.
Although in the two-dimensional case there was, for certain profiles, the shear stress. So far, everything about these 3D models is the same as the 2D models. They were really motivated because there were suggestions that convection in 3D might transport angular momentum outwards. Radial convection motion, that is, not vertical convection motions. And so what we've done mostly is look carefully at the Reynolds stress in this flow, which is difficult because they're not local. There's a mean mass accretion rate, and you've got to subtract that off first. And if you do that, you find that the mass angular momentum transport rate in the convection is consistent with zero. It must be very, very small. So that's probably the most interesting result from the 3D calculation.
Does that mean that the accretion time is really long compared to the freefall time? Or?
Well, that depends on, this still has this anomalous shear stress in here. So that's what's determining the accretion rate, is this anomalous shear stress. Convection is not contributing a significant amount of angular momentum transport.
The convection must have a hell of a time, too, because it's being just sheared out.
Indeed, yeah.
Way bigger. Mm-hmm. So the identity, what is a poor blob to do?
Right. So these MHD models are more attractive because now we don't need this anomalous stress. So any worries or questions that are associated with the shear stress go away. Now you have a physical instability in the initial equilibrium state, which will grow and provide angular momentum transport and accretion self-consistently. And it's related. These models now have sort of an origin in other models. A global evolution of magnetized accretion disks. So those earlier models usually used vertical fields that were connected to corona, and so there were strong magnetic braking effects. Now the magnetic field is entirely contained within the torus. The old field loops entirely contained within the torus. But again, we're able to use a very large radial domain. So you can see the structure of the flow over up to two orders of magnitude in radius to try to measure what its time average properties are like, to compare to steady state solutions.
So you can set up an equilibrium with a magnetic field?
Yes. So because the magnetic field is so weak, however, it doesn't change the equilibrium state. So beta is very large initially, and so the equilibrium state doesn't change. Okay, so let me just show you the analogous plots that I showed you for the hydro models, but now for the magnetic field models now. No anomalous stress here. Here, for example, is the time evolution of these MHD models. Again, contours of log density with shaded regions being negative radial velocity. So here you see early times the inner edge of the torus start to accrete inwards. It gets large amplitude fluctuations, and at late times the inner regions fatten up considerably again. And there's radial streams of flow, both shaded and unshaded regions. And contour lines are all very, very squiggly, meaning there's lots and lots of fluctuations in the density. Again, these fluctuations now are not associated with convection anymore, but now with the Wallace-Hawley instability. That's what's responsible for driving turbulence in this case.
The instability growth rate, you check if the Wallace-Hawley instability matches all the analytics?
Sure, yeah.
This is a poloidal field loop.
Yes, poloidal field loops. So if you look at the mass accretion rates now through just the inner boundary alone versus time for models with different initial field strengths, and once again, you can see that at late times, it saturates at a quasi-steady value. In other words, accretion reaches some maximum rate, and then it seems to stay there for a few dynamical times of the outer regions, although there is a sign that there's a slowly decaying M dot here, which is actually what you would expect for an axisymmetric model, because there isn't a dynamo in axisymmetry, so you can't maintain an amplified poloidal magnetic field. And so on very long timescales, accretion has to die away. How long? A few dynamical times of the outer edge of the torus, which is, say, 10 orbits, which is probably where this is going to die away. So is this worth calculating? It means that this flow at some fundamental level is transitory because it's axisymmetric. You can't get steady accretion. But it's worth studying, I think, still, because of this huge range in orbital times. The orbital time at the initial location of the torus is 350 times the orbital time at the inner edge, which means that one orbit here, 350 orbits in the inner edge. So the flow could be steady in the middle, even though on the outer scale it's changing slowly. So there's some kind of quasi-steady state that might be possible here and worth trying to study.
But isn't there a likelihood that the magnetic field is being sort of expelled from the inner region and you've only got it left on the outside in these long times?
Expelled by buoyancy or by... I'm not sure.
No, chewed up on the inner. I mean, what happens to field in 2D, right, is it gets chewed up and
yes.
consumed by resistance.
So, because this field has an ordered in the initial state, an important... That is true if the field was highly tangled initially, so that the inner regions had no net flux. But, see, what happens is that this inner edge accretes first. It has a net flux. And so you can never get rid of this flux this field has in the inner regions until this bit of the disk comes in and reconnects it. That takes this 5 to 10 orbits of the outer edge to reconnect it. So turbulence is driven and maintained because there's a mean vertical flux, even though integrated over the whole torus is no mean net flux. There can be a separation between the inner edge and the outer edge, which can keep this going in axisymmetry. And interestingly enough, if you take a field which has the same geometry, but if you change the side 10 times here, this way, this way, this way, this way, this, you do that calculation dies away very rapidly, indicating that in that case you're right, and reconnection kills it right away. So if you look at the structure, again at the very inner edge of this torus, or accretion flow, again, it's very complicated in the snapshot. The log density shows lots of fluctuations. This now doesn't seem to be as wide as it was before. The entropy here is very disordered, lots of fluctuations. Now plot also the magnetic field properties. For example, the toroidal magnetic energy is quite large at the very inner and very small in the midpoint of the torus as well. And the Maxwell stress is very disordered in the midplane of the torus again. So it's strongly fluctuating and highly disordered in densest regions of the accretion flow. I'm using the Paczynski-Weta potential here, which has this last stable orbit at around 3 times the radius of the black hole horizon. And what's interesting also is that the flow begins to get very radial, ordered radial structure, the very inner edge. The last stable orbit is, in fact, out here somewhere. So that looks like it's got hair on it at the very inner regions. And so actually this is another interesting aspect of the calculation is examining the nature of the flow right down near that last stable orbit.
What are the sound speeds by number? Show that maybe?
I will in a minute, yes. If you look at 2D contours of this time average flow, now it's a little noisier because I didn't dump out enough data files and the flow is kind of dying away, so I can't evolve it for now. I also can't afford to evolve for 20 orbits in this case anymore. So it's noisier, but nonetheless, trends emerge. For example, the density and pressure contours now are very similar. The flow is more barotropic than it was before. And the angular momentum and entropy contours are no longer parallel anymore. So here, angular momentum contours are only slightly convex. Here, they're very. So they're no longer parallel anymore. So the simple stability criterion, the Hoyland criterion, is not applying, even though the magnetic field here formally is weak. It's a weak field, but you've fundamentally changed the stability properties as we knew, that a generalized stability analysis of a weakly magnetized rotating flow results in a stability criterion which is very different than for a hydrodynamical flow. Magnetic field vectors are shown in the snapshot here, very, very tangled and disordered, consistent with this two-dimensional turbulence.
You say that omega's constant on cylinders?
Yes. Unfortunately, the magnetic field lines are plotted over it, so maybe it's hard to see unless you get very close to it. But within this dense wedge where the accretion flow is occurring, the angular frequency contours are constant on cylinders. Before, they were constant on spherical shells. So it seems to indicate that this magnetic field is trying to enforce co-rotation in the vertical direction. The shear stress in the vertical direction must be significant to keep this thing rigidly. I mean, that's what a magnetic field is trying to enforce, constant omega. It's unable to do so in the radial direction, but it's at least having a good go at it in the vertical direction, I guess.
What is the approximate functional form that is realized in the radial direction at disk center?
Let me show you that, actually. It turns out this is the sort of turbulent accretion flow. There's another kind of accretion flow possible when you have a really strong magnetic field, initially in this torus, which produces an unbound wind, an MHD wind, which is of interest. But I won't show that result, because this is really about the turbulent flows. Instead, I'll show you these time-averaged radial profiles, or profiles of the time-averaged flow. Now they're no longer such clear power laws. You can't really extract what the power law dependence is, if there even is one. Why? Because two things. First of all, the flow is in the outer region, not settled down to a steady state. At R equals 100 RG here, this is still where it's not settled down. Nor will it ever settle down out here, because this is where reconnection is going to kill the MRI. And then down in the inner regions, this Paczynski-Weta potential is considerably altering the flow, not just within the last stable orbit, that's the dashed vertical line, but significantly outside of that as well. If you look at, for example, the radial velocity, it starts to free fall inwards around 6 RG, not 3 RG. And that has a dramatic effect in all the flow variables. Like, for example, the flow goes supersonic right at the last stable orbit, and super alphanic at that point as well. And the Keplerian velocity turns over just where it starts to free fall inwards. And the magnetic field gets combed straight by this free fall. For example, the radial magnetic field is much, much smaller than the azimuthal field throughout the whole domain until you get to the location 6 RG where the stuff free falls. And then the radial field gets really strong because it's just being combed straight. And then BRB5 gets really, really big in this region right here. BR is of order B5 right at this last stable orbit. So the flow structure in the inner regions is significantly altered. Here's this Maxwell stress compared to Reynolds stress. Everywhere, Maxwell stress much bigger than Reynolds in the whole flow. So the accretion is clearly being driven by transport from the magnetic field. So
there was a approximate power law in your omega versus R of RG?
I think there you might hazard a power law, which is, what would it be? A little steeper than R of the minus 1, maybe 3/2.
Your initial pressure beta is what?
Initially, it was a few hundred.
And how small does it get?
If I take the ratio of, say, CS to VA, it'll tell me. It's always bigger than one everywhere. So we don't have such a clean result because the flow is being bounded by unsteady flow on the outside and this inner boundary, which has a significant effect over a larger radial domain. And so it doesn't give you a large enough radial domain to really measure power laws here.
How close to the nominal value of speed of light do you actually get?
CS here. I don't think CS is getting close to the speed of light here. So we're okay. I mean, should this be relativistic? Yes, you should be doing fully relativistic calculations if you wanted to extract certain important properties of the flow here, which this is not relativistic. Okay. So let me show this M dot in and M dot outs again, the victims, as they were called. Again, now you can clearly see the effect of this inner boundary, because now you see there's almost no outflow until you get out to around 10 RG. That, and certainly within this last stable order, everything's falling in. And you don't get any significant outflow until you're quite far from the last stable order. But once you do get this significant outflow, it's back in the same process of an increasing M dot in with radius and M dot accretion staying flat. And so by the outer edge is between 2 and 4 times more material coming in than there is participating in this accretion flow. So once again, there are these turbulent eddies now. However, they're not being driven by convection this time. They're being driven by the MRI. And there's significant mass flux associated with these eddies, which is larger than the mass accretion rate through the whole system. And ideally, you would need another at least decade in radius just to before you could begin to extract any kind of power laws. Let me also say one last thing about
these disks spread just because of some global issues about angular momentum in the whole system, isn't there?
Sorry, the spread.
Well, you have a donut. And
yes.
It goes in and goes out.
Right.
I mean, it's great. What encourages things to go out?
That's conservation of angular momentum. Total angular momentum.
Well, when you look at the field lines, you show this field lines that across polar
yes.
cross section, and it looks like on the inner edge they're pretty much just coming in and going through. And you talked about tangling, but when I looked at those arrows, it looked like so you end up with
so you need a flux.
Sometimes you know, vertical flux, initial vertical flux just pushed into
right.
a much smaller radius here.
So
the field would go up like sort of 1/r².
Indeed, there is a mean field here, as we said before. But
no,
certainly there's arrows
out the top.
Right, and but within the flow itself, there's lots of locations where you find arrows going the opposite way. So the field is tangled up here, but overall, I mean, the amplitude of the fluctuating part of the field seems to be about the same as the amplitude of the mean part of the field here, because it's not dominated by one nor the other.
As you're getting closer. As
here?
You get closer in and the high and the low parts.
Right. These parts here, remember, are where you're getting to be outside the midpoint of the accretion flow, where the density is getting much lower and there aren't nearly as many. And there's holes, there's a cone in this flow, an evacuated region above and below, where the field indeed is very ordered there. But within the midplane, where the MRI is saturated, there's lots of fluctuation and turbulence, then.
Yes, but then if you look down on top,
okay.
Right, these field lines are connected
right
out.
Yes.
So you should see a tremendous, you know, Parker spiral type thing.
If beta were one, yeah, there would be enormous global stress here, and the thing would
ratchet
to a
halt. Well, how many times has the inside gone around compared to
by now, they've gone around 1,000 times.
Mm-hmm. On the inside.
On the inside.
And the outside's pretty much not gone around at all.
Two or three times. So for every 3 orbits of the outside, there's
one
or 1,000
orbits. So the field line is going to stretch to 1,000 times.
If it were completely ideal MHD, and so you could never reconnect the field, then I would agree.
But do you have a view from on top? Does it look like that?
Well, you're isosymmetric. You, of course, are still allowed to
right.
drag the field line around, right? But without any ripples.
Yes, but you'd make a huge spiral.
Of course, yeah.
But any diffusion will then, therefore, this bring both mm-hmm. together.
All right, I think this field here, where there's lots of changes in the sign of the field, there's going to be lots of reconnection.
But can we try your calculation admits of D5, right?
Yes, absolutely.
As you say, it stretches the Dickens.
Right, right, right.
And then is there a lot of reconnection on the D5 components?
On all components, yes. So there is also an important thing to actually tell you about here, which I've forgotten, is that there is in fact a resistivity in this calculation, an anomalous resistivity, a resistivity which is proportional to the current density. Why do you put this in? Because this flow is non-radiative, it's adiabatic, and any magnetic field dissipation should result in heat generation, and that heat generation could lead to convective transport. So you want to get the energy budget right in this case. If you dissipate magnetic energy through reconnection, you want to make sure you capture that energy. So, in fact, the reconnection regions here are significant and they're resolved. And the heat flux, the energy loss from the magnetic field does go into the thermal energy of the gas here. So this is not an ideal NHD. There's certainly reconnection going on.
I'm looking at tremendously ordered field above the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And are the lengths of the arrows important?
No. In fact, they're very unimportant because I only showed directions. That's somewhat misleading, but if I don't do that, it's hard to see the arrows in locations where these eddies are.
Could you change also the your resistivity, effective resistivity, to change the connection speed and see what will do the changes?
Certainly you can change the magnitude of the resistivity. If you make it very large, then you lower the growth rate of the MRI and you lower the amplitude of the saturated state.
Nobody wants to make it large.
No, right. I can't make it any smaller than the grid scale. So that's what I make it. I make the anomalous resistivity large enough so that current sheets are spread out over a few grid zones, and so they're resolved.
What's the value of magnetic reynolds number?
So that's not so sure that's a meaningful question, however, because it's anomalous resistivity. It changes as a function of current density. So in the current sheets itself, the Reynolds number is around unity, because I want these sheets to be spread out over a few zones. But away from the current sheets, Reynolds number is very high. If it's comparable to the Reynolds number I measure in another application of this code, it must be about 10,000 or so.
What velocity is that based on?
On the sound speed in the flow. So there's lots of details I can see that
you could be here for a week.
I could be here for a week. I can't be here for a week. I was here for a week.
It was.
There's a difference.
That was the week that was.
Okay. So I was going to show you one last picture, which is now not a time average profile, but a snapshot, just to reinforce how time dependent the MHD flow is. Here's a profile along the equatorial plane of the density and the Reynolds stress the Maxwell stress taken at one particular instant of time. And what's interesting is by how much these quantities vary. This is being normalized by the field energy, so this is like the alpha parameter measured with the magnetic field pressure here. The alpha here is varying by more than an order of magnitude. Different radial locations. And associated with that huge fluctuation in the stress is a very large fluctuation in the density. There's a big blob of material which is accreting in rapidly because there's a huge shear stress associated with that blob of material. And so the accretion flow is very, very dynamic, very, very time dependent, and the mass accretion rate has enormous fluctuations in it. And there may be some kind of secular instability as being discussed for global models of disks. When the shear stress is given by this magnetic field. And so it's quite obvious, I think, that these flows are going to be very, very time dependent. So let me finish up by saying that, indeed, most of our effort, I guess, nowadays is on global models. But it's been worthwhile in that even the simplest 2D case, which was just supposed to be a test run, so we have these 2D hydro models to which we can compare the MHD and understand the differences. Well, it turns out the 2D hydri in and of themselves are very interesting. They have very, very vigorous convection, and that the flow properties are completely determined or controlled by that convection, giving a very small m dot in the middle compared to certain self-similar solutions. And it could be important to interpretation of observations because m dot is low here. There's little difference between the 2D and the 3D hydro models, but at its face value, I think it says that the convection in the 3D case is very inefficient as a mechanism for transporting momentum. That is convection in the radial direction as opposed to vertical convection in thin disks. Again, the MHD models show biggest transport and turbulence. And of course, everything here is limited again by this axisymmetry. And there are some 3D MHD models available now to which you can compare these results. So things like the magnitude of the shear stress and the mass accretion rate in these models are consistent with the fully 3D models. But nonetheless, if you're really going to measure the profiles of these steady state flows, you'd really like to do that in 3D. That's going to be very challenging but essential. I think it's only a matter of time. So I'll finish there. Thank you.
I had a question. Someone asked, but wanted you to elaborate on how you set up the initial equilibrium in the
global calculation, how do you know that it's an MHD field? Do you have a...
Well, I do the simplest thing. I just make beta really big, and I make it, I make B squared, the contours of B squared are parallel to the contours of key. So I've effectively added a slight perturbation to the pressure. So it's not an exact equilibrium. There's a 1% change in the pressure. The torus, if left alone, would oscillate a little bit because of this. It's not quite in pressure equilibrium. But before that can happen, this MRI takes over, everything falls in. Doesn't seem worth trying to make it any quieter. In fact, I add in random fluctuations in P and rho and V in order to see the instability to begin with anyways. So you don't want a perfect start. If you had an absolutely perfect start, you wouldn't get any instability because you wouldn't see any unstable nodes.
I might have missed it, but did you see anything in the hydro case which was analogous to the topologizing equivalent?
No, we didn't, because again, for the amplitude of the shear stress we used, the infall was happening within a couple of orbits, which was not enough time for the Papoisa-Prinz instability to grow and saturate. So it's falling in before it's really gotten going.
In the calculations where you have the tremendous inflow coming in around the, because of this black hole potential, that must have been kind of disappointing, right? You have this enormous, almost all your time must be spent integrating that little bit where it's just going straight in.
Well, it depends on your perspective, I guess, because there's lots of people who are extremely interested in the accretion flow near the event horizon. In fact, of course, there are observations of that region. The iron K alpha line, I think, is directly relevant to this regime here. And so interpreting the Doppler line widths from the observations, X-ray observations of the iron line could well rely on these kind of calculations.
If you were really interested in that, you wouldn't have evolved all the rest of that stuff. You could do a simulation that had
that zone in it. We've got to
know how to repeat it. Right, that's the problem. If you put it too close in, then the flow really is a transient. The whole thing accretes in a couple of orbits. So, for example, the 3D calculations use a much smaller radial grid, and indeed, the black hole eats everything after about 10 orbits. So the flow never reaches a steady state accretion flow because it's just too close. You need to get it far enough away that the flow reaches some kind of quasi-steady structure, but as close as possible to save computational time, I guess. I would say we're not yet far enough away, and that we need to be in 3D.
Could you perhaps comment a little bit on the properties of turbulence that might exist in the presence of this inexorable shear, the Keplerian shear? Is a real tough place to live in the world. And so we tend to say that the convection does something, but these convective entities have a tough time because if they change their radial positions, they change their locations a great deal. Have you thought about what do you do to turbulence when you're in this?
I can't say that I've thought about it carefully. We have measured the power spectrum in these local boxes, and it doesn't seem to be any difference in the slopes, for example. So if there is a cascade, it doesn't, or to the extent that you can measure these slopes, that there's no effect on them. Suppose that cascade was different in the azimuthal directions, say, compared to the radial directions. You don't see any evidence for that in the data. What you do see is evidence for much different levels of fluctuations in the two directions. I guess it's to zeroth order. That's the primary effect of the shear, is to continuously enhance the azimuthal fluctuations at the expense of everything else, especially the radial fluctuations.
But in an ordered way, so.
In a very ordered way. Right.
Maybe you said this, but as you're approaching the black hole, is there a laminarization of the flow because it's supersonic?
And the picture, the color picture I showed, everything seemed to have little radial streaks to it once you got really close to the inner boundary. So it really was getting ordered once you got in. The MRI gets shut off and it's dominated by this free fall inwards. Once you're within, not the last stable orbit, but it seems to be around 6 RG, around twice the last stable orbit.
So what's carrying momentum out of it?
So beyond 3RG, you need something to carry angular momentum outwards. Right. And there you're getting a huge correlation in BRB5 because of this free fall is combing the field and BR is getting large. And so you saw the Maxwell stress go up there. Once you're inside 3RG, then game's over. You can still be transporting angular momentum outwards, however. Right, you can still have outflow, or you can still have torques associated with a gas which is inside that last stable orbit. Some recent work, analytic work on the structure of the accretion flow and a time-steady accretion flow within this last stable orbit, which I think is very relevant for comparison and for interpretation of these kind of calculations.
Could you say something about the current status of these last fully 3D MHD models?
So
over several days.
Right. I think that the problem is that you can't afford a parameter survey. So what the 2D calculations are useful for is figuring out what is the size of the grid you need to use, what's field strength, geometry, and so on. And then the idea at the moment is to evolve the 2D model until it's saturated, and then to interpolate that onto a 3D grid, give it perturbations in the phi direction, and then evolve it for another orbit after that. That saves you this five orbits of letting it, and of course it's going to be a big transient because the 2D flow is not consistent with what the 3D wants to do, but that'll hopefully be less expensive. So I think that we could do the same grid in 3D with a lot of computer time and with this technique, and I think there are plans afoot for that.
And are your codes graceful on massively parallel machines?
Reasonably graceful, yes, depending on what massively parallel machine you mean. They're all different in CNC. So we have versions that work on the SP2 and versions that work on the Origin 2000 and use those in parallel and concert.
How do you cope with the coordinate singularities in this mesh point method?
So there are two approaches that have been taken. For the 3D calculations, you use a cylindrical grid, and you leave out the axis along the pole. In the 3D calculations, you can two things. You either just pay the cost of having these very small angular zones near the poles, or else you leave out a wedge within a few degrees of the pole. And because the flow is evacuated there, the contours of variables seem to show a hole in the middle up there, then that might be okay. There are better ways to do it, which requires doing some major effort in the code development. And again, I have a student, or a postdoc, I should say, working on improving the code to be able to handle those, but it's going to be a while yet.
Self-consistent chips you can't make right now.
No. Right. And perhaps that does require GR and relativity. If you worry about Blandford genetic effect and so on, you might really want to do GR.
What about the protostellates? They're having incredibly high accretion rates, probably alpha around unity or something. What would you say? Your alpha is still very low here.
Right. Well, no, alpha itself is quite large. The plot showed it being 0.2. I didn't point this out in the radial profile of the Maxwell stretch of radius, gives you quite a large alpha. So here's the amplitude of the Maxwell stress, and it's around 0.2 to 0.3. But the mass accretion rate seems to be low. But there could be a big difference between these thick accretion flows and thin disks, like protostellar disks. Thin disks will have a maximum spatial scale imposed by the thickness of the disk, and you can't get turbulent eddies that are much bigger than that scale height. And that may change the global structure of the flow. Compared to these flows, where H is of all order R, everywhere, and you can have turbulent eddies that are really, really big at every radius. But doing thin disks is more difficult computationally, because now, you have this thin little plate which you want to evolve over many decades in radius, and so your grid has to resolve the vertical structure over two decades in radius, and that's very difficult computationally. So it made much more sense to do the thick disks first and leave the thin disks for later efforts. But you're right, doing thin disks in these global models is very important, and it might change the fundamental nature of the flow.
The accretion has to be higher.
It's possible, yes, I think. If they're rated and they're able to get rid of their accretion energy.
Is is this in this calculation, are both of the viscosities and resistivities numerical?
In this calculation, the resistivity is not numerical. The viscosity is.
Do you have any insight into whether, you know, the comparison of the natural stress and the normal stress, whether that might depend on travel in some way?
No, because that requires, for a rigorous answer, a set of calculations with different Prandtl numbers, which we don't have. I can tell you stories about how it should change, the Prandtl number should change it, but I can't test those until you can do the calculations. So the answer is no.
So what do you do with your resistivity here? How is that treated?
So it has a coefficient of resistivity which is proportional to the current density.
So
in fact, I was happy to see Russell Kulsdrew tell us that this is consistent with the tokamak experiments, that the anomalous resistivity should be proportional to J. Because fortuitously, that's what people in the solar corona business have been doing. People studying jets, X-ray jets in solar corona have added this, they're looking at reconnection in solar corona, they've added this anomalous resistivity of this form. I take the same form as what they have.
But you then jack up to the strength of it.
To give you a Reynolds number of unity, right, in the current sheet, but vanishingly small everywhere else.
So those models, the onset of anomalous resistivity,
but they don't resolve an instability. I mean, they put an empirical formula.
But for example, in the HL medium, if you calculate the critical current density, say, for the ionic instability, it's far, far higher than anything you would expect, you know, sort of, for the HL medium as we know it.
Right.
So what's the situation in the system? Do you think it's reasonable to expect?
Well, the truth is my motivation for adding anomalous resistivity is not because I want to capture a plasma instability at certain scales here. It's more simple than that. It's that I don't want to lose energy through magnetic reconnection. And since I know that MRI saturates because of reconnection, I know this is a very important process in the energy budget. And so I want to make sure that I turn magnetic energy into thermal energy, and so that if this gets hotter and convective, if it wants to convect. So it means that I have a resistivity, a coefficient of resistivity, which is probably way, way, way bigger than what it should be if I was really relying on microphysical plasma processes to give me an anomalous resistivity. So I can't claim to have modeled the real plasma dynamics.
You keep saying, Jim, that the magneto-rotational instability.
Yes.
Saturates because of reconnection.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand how that must be so. I mean, it must be some nonlinear process. How is it that it becomes nothing?
How is the reconnection becoming nonlinear? The reconnection is being driven by the velocity fluctuation. So magnetic field lines of opposite sign are being forced together. And then because of the finite grid resolution, they cancel away. So you're losing this magnetic energy associated with eddies, which are forcing together fields of opposite sign. So that results in a net loss of magnetic energy, a net change in the field topology, and is a saturation mechanism for instability.
Has somebody done a calculation that shows how it ends up?
So
normally you think of saturation somehow modifying the flows.
So you worry that this reconnection rate is set by the numerical dissipation. So there's some coefficient you could assign for numerical resistivity. And you think, well, gee, saturation amplitude must depend very strongly on that. But if you run calculations of different numerical resolutions, they all have the same saturated amplitude as long as the unstable wavelengths are resolved. So that tells you that it's not dependent on the coefficient of the numerical resistivity. Why is that so? It's because it's the amplitude of the velocity fluctuations that matter. It's how hard you smash together these field lines. If you make the grid resolution even finer, so you've got to bring them together even closer, then the flow adjusts itself so that you get...
If you bring field lines together, mm-hmm, for an opposite side,
yes,
you make these a bit larger. Right? I mean, you make these a bit larger unless you can reconnect faster. And if it's just not clear, that, I mean,
a saturation that wouldn't depend on grid would be just, you know, the forces, the J cross B forces, that are altering the flux.
B is still less important. B squared is still less than the gas pressure. Still less than right, but so less than the kinetic energy fluctuations where it's being brought together. So, I mean, what can I say? This is the mechanism by which you bring these field lines together.
This is really interesting. In a numerical calculation, the time step, and actually there's a time mesh and there's an X mesh.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if you drive two fields together, but you do it over a very short time, there won't be, it'll just kind of also kind of splash and bounce off each other. So, but there's like a minimum time scale in these calculations, which has to do with the delta T, and so whenever you bring them together, you've brought them together for long enough to merge under the, the mesh size by virtue of
I think it's also important to remember that on a finite mesh, all you know is the field averaged over a certain area. So when you bring this field line together, there is no time scale for reconnection. That is, once the field line become within one grid zone apart, then when you do this averaging, then it's immediately gone. There's no physical mechanism required to get rid of it. It's just gone. Because you take minus one and you put plus one and you get zero out of it.
And the usual problem is that in order to bring them together, you have to have a very large negative divergence.
Mm-hmm.
And
Large enough. And that's what you have.
And then you have tremendous flows along the field.
Mm-hmm.
That's usually kind of hard to do because, first of all, you've got the magnetic pressure that's pushing back. The flow along the field is what's hard to make. Very large.
I mean, in three dimensions, then there is plenty of geometry. I mean, you're not necessarily bringing together two planar fields. You're bringing together small little field segments with lots of opening angle for the stuff to get out of the way of. I just don't know what to say other than it just doesn't seem to be a problem in reaching the flow. I mean, I think you could extract a tiny little volume and look at the evolution of the magnetic field on very short time scales and watch this reconnection proceeding. If you really want to understand the microphysics or the small scale dynamics of how this reconnection is proceeding, to be honest, we haven't done that. There's a lot of grid zones and there's reconnection going on everywhere. It's hard to know where, we haven't really focused on any one little area to look at this. Maybe it's an interesting problem to be looking at.
I have a question for you that might be related, but it sounds slightly different. When you look at the visualization of the simulation, it's dominated by these great big A's. Now, I can't do a Fourier transform with my eye. Wondering.
These are the global calculations?
The global calculations, mm-hmm. Right. And then at the same time, in the beginning of your talk, you talked about being able to do a small local simulation and getting similar results. But how can those be commensurate?
Well, this is one of the major motivations of doing the global calculation, is to ask, is there a cutoff in the turbulent spectrum such that the outer disk is disconnected from the inner disk? Or are there field loops which extend over the whole disk? You don't know. The local calculations can't tell you that because you can't study anything beyond the size scale of the box. So that's one of the major motivations of doing the global calculations. And at the moment, for the limited dynamic range in the 3D calculations, there are field loops which extend over a large radial domain. And so this is significantly enhancing alpha. This is perhaps why, even without a mean magnetic field, alpha is 0.2 and 0.3 in these global models.
Right, but if you had resolution of the small scale, would you expect for those large eddies to go away?
No, I see no reason why they would go away by adding smaller scales. I don't see any reason why the small k power spectrum is going to be changed completely by adding many more larger k. I'm biased by the philosophy of direct numerical simulation of turbulence, which is sort of based on that.
Yeah, but in the fluid world, it's different because you have one viscosity and you can push it away, but in the MHD world, you have this difference between chewing that magnetic field and chewing that viscosity.
Mm-hmm.
Things can be very tricky.
Agreed. So understanding how this panel number affects things is important. And I'm afraid the calculations haven't been done yet to answer those kind of questions. All we really know is the behavior for panel number around one, and for resistivity much bigger than viscosity.
How about restricting the mesh to not 2 pi, but less than that? Is that
taking a smaller volume?
No, a smaller angle.
Oh, right.
And then periodicity. Maybe quarter or something.
Right. Then of course you don't get the lower M modes, which might be important.
But if you are having a local instability, then of course you wouldn't really think that should be solved for.
For the local instability, that's correct. However, we're interested in the global structure. So this instability might be setting up global waves, for example, that might affect the global structure of the disk itself. So you don't want to throw away interesting aspects of the global calculation, even though the local physics doesn't really probably depend on that.
But you have a strong shear going on, which suggests that you do want to look at the whole circle
right.
going round.
Yeah. When you look at the 3D calculations today, they all seem to be dominated by n equals 1 spirals. So that does seem to suggest that the 2 pi, is having the full 2 pi is important.
Yeah.
It's really not that big a saving anyways, 5 or 4 maybe. So
yeah, that's
right. It's not 10 or 100, which is what you really need to enable new things.
Factor 4 data, factor 4 data.